supportive of one another, and they each have a distinct flavor, all having to do with attention and the quality of attention. So concentration helps stabilize attention, so it's more steady, it's not so flickering and wild. Mindfulness will refine or unclutter attention. Probably the classical translation would be purify, but I sometimes have some problems with that word, so I'm trying not to say purify. So let's say refine. Clarify attention. And loving kindness will open attention so that we pay attention both to in a different way and to those perhaps we might otherwise tend to ignore. So there are lots of ways in which it opens us to be more inclusive, and so on. They each can be pursued together, and in a way are pursued together. It's like when I said, I really do believe loving kindness and compassion are being developed, even if the words are never ever used. Because let's just go back in time a few minutes to the last time in this sitting you were distracted, like way distracted, like gone. And back to that moment where you sort of said, oh, right, the breath. That's a moment in which we need to be deepening the force of loving kindness and compassion for ourselves, or we would never be able to start over. So it's kind of interwoven there, even if we don't talk about it. And of course, there are distinct techniques which we'll explore today that are particularly about the deepening of loving kindness and compassion, resting upon the foundation, you could say, of these other qualities. So sometimes I try to describe mindfulness and loving kindness in these ways. A friend of mine named Sherry Maples, when I was visiting Madison, Wisconsin, took me to a prison where she'd been teaching meditation. So the fact that we were in a prison is totally irrelevant to the story, but it's where it happened to take place. So at some point in the day, Sherry said she would like three people to leave the room. And because it was a prison, a staff person had to go with them. So that meant four people left the room. And Sherry said to those of us staying in the room, she said, I want you to take any material that you see, anything that's here in the room, and make a kind of structure in the middle of the room. So there wasn't a lot in the room. There were chairs. So the guys got up, and they were like piling chairs on top of one another, and there were a few flags, so they stuck the flags in at a certain angle, and we'd taken off our shoes, so there were some shoes that could go on that pile, and I think maybe there was one plant or something, so they put the plant there. Then they sat down. So I looked at this mound of chairs and flags, and clearly because of the flags that evoked certain feelings in me, I looked at it and I thought, oh, that's a monument. And it evoked these feelings of, you know, triumph and valor and challenge and tragedy and overcoming tragedy and heroism. And then one by one, Sherry asked the people who'd left the room to come in. So the first person came in, and she said to them, what do you see? So they took a look at this pile, and he said, I see a monument. And I thought, smart fellow. How discerning is he? Of course, he's right. It's a monument. And each person that came in described something very different in terms of what they saw, including the staff person came in and he said, I see chaos. I just see chaos. So she, of course, was trying to use this exercise to talk about the nature and the power of mindfulness. Our minds will always make up stories, and that's fine. It's not that we're trying to destroy that narrative capacity or annihilate it, but we want to know what's actually in front of us and the story that we're making up about it. And then we have a choice. Do we want to pursue it, nurture it? Some stories are incredibly important and positive. They bring us together. They open doors of possibility. They open our sense of aspiration. Some stories are extremely old and damaging. And we have enough space in the mindfulness to see, this is what's in front of me. This is the layer of, you could say, story or interpretation or judgment or conclusion or future projection, whatever it might be, that is then arising. Do I want to go with it or do I want to just let it go? Let it go doesn't mean hate it, but it means relinquishing its hold. Because, you know, I told the story of Lucy yesterday. If you really knew who you were, it would be a big problem. The problem with you is that you're you. And it's a very familiar story to a lot of people. But it's a much healthier thing to be able to recognize it as a story and be able to say, chill out, Lucy. Something like that. So here too, you know, all those places where people sometimes think of mindfulness as so passive and kind of surrendering to everything, there's a tremendous element of choice, which is very powerful. But we can only make that choice when we see. This is what's happening. This is what is being made of it. So another example, someone's phone went off yesterday and I thought of this other story. About this time I was in New York City and I was supposed to meet a friend of mine in like a cafe in the afternoon, and she was really, really, really late. So I took out my cell phone, which is virtually never on, and I turned it on and I left it on the table and I waited and waited and waited and never rang. Finally, about 45 minutes later, she walked in and I said, where were you? You never called. And she said, I called you 4 times. You never answered. And that's when I realized my cell phone wasn't ringing. And I spent hours, like, pressing things, trying to get it to ring. I could never get it to ring. So that night I was teaching with somebody, and he spoke first. And as he was speaking, someone's cell phone went off. So when it was my turn to speak, I started with that. And I said, here's a sound that entered this room. So many times we have an experience and the reaction comes so quickly that in our minds they fuse as one. The sound and the feeling about it, the sound and the reaction to it conflate. And when that happens, that reaction takes on a certain aura of permanence, certainty, rigidity, inevitability, and universality, as though all people at all times must always feel exactly like that about that sound. And we don't even know it. Whereas if we're mindful, we hear the sound, we see the beginning of the reaction, we either can let it go or we do something about it. Or work to enhance it or enrich it in some way. So I said, you know, here was the sound. The cell phone went off. Perhaps the person whose phone it was felt somewhat chagrined or embarrassed. Perhaps some other people in the room felt amused or annoyed. I was sitting there listening to the sound of the cell phone and I just felt envious. I thought, wow. And in fact, that came up yesterday too. Not in exactly the same way, but in that time in New York, I thought, that person's cell phone rings. My phone can't even ring. And not only that, and this came up yesterday, I like that ringtone better than my ringtone. That's a good ringtone. How do I get that ringtone? One sound, right? Lots of different possible responses and feelings, and they're not all the same. Some are based on real ignorance, some are based on wisdom, all kinds of different conditioning. So it's not like saying every reaction is the same, but every reaction is conditioned. Every reaction is born out of conditions. And it's not the same thing as hearing the sound. So mindfulness gives us that chance to see this is the experience, this is the story. And I would say, going back to the prison story for a second, what the intensive loving-kindness cultivation gives us is a different default story. That very quickly rushing in, nearly immediate, ready story shifts. So if it has been Lucy for a good long time, if you really knew who you were, that would be a big problem. That story shifts. It's not to say Lucy is banished, never to be seen again, but that kind of common, very frequently arising, more frequently arising than anything kind of story, that theme song, shifts. So if our story has largely been one of fear, that has been guiding what we do and what we say, and we cultivate the power of loving kindness and compassion, it will shift so that we are more motivated from a place of connection. We see the world differently. And so what rushes in is not so much a story about self and other and us and them and fear and so on. It's more about connection. It's more about how can we be happy, rather than so much about either ourselves or never about ourselves. Something like that. And that's why a practice of loving kindness meditation, it's one of the reasons it's very interesting, in fact, because the common belief and the common anxiety is that it's going to be really phony, like you're trying to talk yourself into something that you don't really feel, and that there's this image of this kind of like goody-goody, you know, and that you're trying to mold yourself into that image, and it's not happening, but you're laying this veneer on top, and that it's kind of gooey and saccharine, and it's so, the reality is so very different than that. It's much more a sense of so much transitioning within in terms of that common story, common frequent, usually arising default story, that we find that we are different without self-consciousness. You know, you're in a conversation with somebody, and you realize you're not actually paying attention to them, and you come back. Not because you're giving yourself a lecture, like, oh man, I spent all day Sunday trying to do loving kindness practice, and here I am, and I'm, you know, I can't even talk to the stranger without being consumed by my email. I'm a horrible meditator. I better force myself, you know, to really listen to them. It's not like that. There's just been a shift so that you realize you're distracted. You want to be there. So you come back. Or so many different things like that, which we'll, you know, talk about throughout the day. And that's why there's a kind of, it's not haphazard, but there's a kind of naturalness, too, to the development of loving kindness. You feel better in listening and sharing and acts of kindness, things like that. So it's not this sort of dramatic, self-conscious, forced, coerced effort. I teach an intensive loving kindness retreat every year in Massachusetts in the winter. You're all invited. No one complains about how hot it is. But we do heat the building very well. And I remember, it's a 7-day intensive retreat, and I remember one year a guy came up to me at the beginning of the retreat, and I imagine he was there to make someone else happy, because the first thing he said to me was, I hate this practice. He said, I absolutely detest loving kindness practice because it reminds me of a continually enforced Valentine's Day. Like, on the count of three, you will be filled with love, you know, like totally disconnected from an inner reality just this kind of phony, pretentious effort. But I'm happy to say by the end of the retreat, he was saying something very different. Sometimes it's good to do things, even not for yourself, that way. Or I have a friend in New York, I can't remember if I said this the other night, I have a friend in New York City who's reading the first book I wrote, which is called Loving Kindness, and he said he was very interested in the practice, but he was so embarrassed to be seen publicly reading a book called Loving Kindness that sitting on the subway, he was like kind of cleverly placing his finger over the title. And I thought, wow, it's like the old pornography thing, you know, like a brown paper bag or something. But it's not surprising. I hear it so many times from all genders and all kinds of people that there's just this squeamishness around what we have now taken love or loving kindness to be, or what has been superimposed as a kind of cultural narrative about the nature of these qualities, that they're weak and kind of stupid or foolish and people will take advantage of you and you've got to be tough and strength is found elsewhere, like in closing down or in revenge. I mean, there's so many things that we have incorporated, and that's why it's actually a very deep practice. One fear people have is that it's this kind of superficial, almost like a induction of a state that's not real. But it's quite challenging because we look at a lot in terms of our ideas about aloneness, about strength, about happiness, about the nature of love, about where power comes from. All kinds of things come up in that process. So I consider it a really fun practice. And I said the other day, it's the kind of practice where you need to have a certain spirit of adventure, because the fruit of the practice, the consequence of the practice, may not appear in your formal sitting period or your formal walking period. It's more likely to appear in your life when you are standing in line in the supermarket, when you're challenged in some way at the airport. I don't want to curse myself on trying to avoid those stories, but I can't avoid them totally. There's so many. In life, when you make a mistake and you need to be able to start over with some heartfulness rather than just be stuck in that mistake as though that were all that you were, things like that. So that's why, you know, it's the kind of practice one can undertake with a forced air, which would be very painful, like, where's the love? I don't know if this is really love. How conditioned is this love? I think I had unconditioned love for 5 minutes yesterday. Why don't I have it for 15 today? I'm not doing this right, you know. Or you can just do it and see what happens over time in your life, which is clearly the path I would suggest. In an exploration, and we'll talk about the nature of the practice as well as the Eightfold Path throughout the day today. It's done, you know, as I said, sitting, it's done walking. We're going to start by doing it walking, doing the practice walking and seeing what our experience is, and then come back and do some sitting. One way of seeing the practice of loving kindness is as a practice of generosity. It's not material generosity, but it's like generosity of the spirit. And the first recipient of that generosity is ourselves. So we are making an offering to ourselves. And we move on from ourselves in lots of different ways. Now I'm talking about sitting particularly. And culminate in the offering of loving kindness to all beings everywhere, to all of life. And there are various ways we might offer loving kindness in that middle portion between ourselves and all beings. The practice is done both in sitting and in walking through the silent repetition of certain phrases. So rather than gathering our attention around the feeling of the breath, we're gathering our attention around these phrases. Walking can also be done in just that way, starting with yourself and moving through these categories and ending with all beings. That's one option. I tend not to do that myself, but so I'm going to suggest to you what I do, which is my favorite way of doing loving kindness while walking. But the principle is basically the same. We have an object of attention, which is the phrase. We have a light awareness on it, because you don't want to be like barging into people as you're thinking, maybe happy, you know. So your eyes are open, walking. You're aware of everything going on around you, but you have this light attention resting on these phrases. Okay, and in both sitting and walking, your mind will go a billion different places. You realize you've been distracted. You gently let go. See if you can bring your attention back. It's really helpful not to have a sense of forcing. I have to feel love by, what time are we ending today? You know? Maybe half an hour before the end. You know, so just let it happen, whatever happens. The power of the practice is not in manufacturing or fabricating an emotion, it's in that gathering. It's that complete, wholehearted presence behind one phrase at a time. That's how the practice develops. That's how one makes progress. The phrases that we use tend to be quite general, because this is an offering we want to make for ourselves and for others. And in addition to the kind of balance I've been talking about with tranquility and alertness or energy and calm, there's another sort of balance that comes into play, another question of balance that comes into play, particularly in doing loving kindness practice. And that is between, and it's similar to energy and calm, but has its own particular manifestation, and that is, on the one side, structure, simplicity, which really helps deepen the concentration. And the other side is creativity, energy, which helps the practice be alive, be meaningful. So the structure, the simplicity, is especially important in loving kindness practice because it's so relational. We're calling people to mind, or in walking meditation, someone's coming by. Or we hear a dog, maybe we're afraid of dogs. It's very, very easy in loving kindness practice to spin out for a long story. Because these are real relationships. Relationships are complicated. And so on the side of simplicity, we say things like, see if you can use good enough phrases so that you're not going to be tempted to change them all the time. One problematic scenario would be something like using a phrase, may I be happy for yourself, it's fine. You call to mind a friend, you start, may you be happy, it's fine. And then you call to mind another friend and you begin, may you be happy, and then you think, well, maybe not you. You know, you get really lazy when you get happy. Maybe what, content? No, you'd really go to sleep if you were content. Maybe what, you know? Because then we're just gone. And we've lost the power of that kind of intentness, like, may you be happy, may you be peaceful, may you be happy. That concentration is what's going to really generate the power of the practice. So we choose good enough phrases that feel like we more or less can use them for ourselves and for others. It's not always perfect, And sometimes someone will come to mind and they almost like bring a set of phrases with them. And that's fine. You don't have to feel imprisoned by this. But rest on the structure. It will help deepen the practice. Now, I first did this practice intensively in a structured way, in a guided way, in Burma in 1985. And my teacher was Sayadaw Upandita, and he said to me, go back to your room and offer loving kindness to a good friend. And so I went back to my room, and I thought of someone right away. And then I thought, what's the time difference between Northampton, Massachusetts and Rangoon? Huh, what time is it there? I think it's dinner time. I wonder if she went out to dinner. Where might she have gone to dinner? Would she have gone to the Italian restaurant, or would she have gone to the Greek restaurant, or might she have gone to the No, she wouldn't have gone to the Japanese restaurant. I think that closed. Isn't that odd? Restaurants on that corner always close. I don't know why it is. It has really good parking. It's very close to Smith College. I don't know why they close. Maybe it's got bad feng shui. What is feng shui anyway? You know? It's like, it's very, very easy in this practice to do that. We're calling to mind someone real. Relationships are complicated. So we are saved by remembering simplicity. That the power is not going to come from thinking things through, but from that complete wholehearted presence behind the phrases. As we go in the sitting through various categories, we also have to choose good enough people for the categories. After offering loving kindness to oneself in sitting, one offers loving kindness to a benefactor, someone who's helped us. Here too, things can get complicated. Sometimes people say, well, you know, I thought of this person and they're my benefactor and they were so good to me and so generous and I was going along swimmingly, and then I remembered, you know, there was that one time I called them and they really weren't there for me. Maybe they're not my benefactor. Maybe they're my difficult person, you know, because life is complicated. So the categories too, they're an artificial structure. They're useful. So you don't have to think, I've got to get the perfect benefactor where the relationship has no ripples at all. It's not going to be. It doesn't matter. It's a way of unfolding the practice through various kinds of challenges. So that's the simplicity side. It's very important. The other side is energy. You don't want this to be rote and meaningless, and you just could be saying anything and it has no juice to it. And there are different ways we work with being creative and helping things come alive. Sometimes that has to come after we've established some sense of that structure and simplicity, so we have a foundation for then kind of playing. It might mean trying to get a richer sense of the object, the recipient of the loving kindness. It might mean using imagination, like, what would a happy circumstance look like for ourselves or for someone else? You know, there are lots of ways in which we also work with that and work with the balance between the two. So to begin with doing the walking, the way I like to do loving kindness walking is not so much going through the various categories, because I find that a little too much, although you're welcome to, as we go through the day, you know, to experiment with that later on if you prefer, if you have experience in that way. The way I like to do loving kindness walking is basically to have a baseline of the phrases for myself, choosing two or three phrases. Sometimes four. I wouldn't do more than four. We tend to do four in the sitting and walking. You know, four even might be too many. And we repeat those phrases, two or three or whatever it is, over and over again. with that light attention. Sometimes people like to coordinate the phrase with the pace of their step. It's up to you. But it's not particularly like an exquisite mindfulness exercise on the sensations of the step. Our touchstone is the repetition of the phrases. We say walk at any speed, and this is a good one to do in the neighborhood because you can walk at any speed. And what I like to do, as I said, is basically rest my attention on the phrases for myself. Things like, may I be happy, may I be peaceful. May I be happy, may I be peaceful. And then when someone comes to mind, someone walks by or comes by, you hear a bird, you hear a dog, you see a bug, someone comes strongly into your consciousness, include them for a few moments, like, oh, be happy. And then go back to the phrases for yourself. Especially if you're outside, there's a lot of life out there, you know, and it'd be easy to get really jangled, like, oh, be happy, be happy, be happy, be happy. Which is why I like to have the baseline of the phrases for myself. It just gives me a kind of grounding. And it's fun to include, to see what happens. And maybe you are afraid of dogs, and you hear a dog. What happens is you say, oh, be happy. You just take a look at that whole rich play of feeling. You come back to the phrases for yourself. So, eyes open. I should also say, emphatically, silent repetition of the phrases. I was teaching in Berkeley once in a yoga center, and everyone had to go out in the streets of Berkeley to do the walking meditation, and either I had not been clear enough or someone misunderstood, because they came back and they said, well, I saw this group of people on the street corner and I brought up all my courage and I went up to them and I said, may you be happy. And I thought, well, at least it's Berkeley, you know. Could be bad, actually. So eyes open, silent repetition of certain phrases, two or three phrases, really general like that. May I be happy, may I be peaceful, or whatever you choose along those lines. Sometimes people don't like that construct, may I, may you. It doesn't sound right. It's meant to have a feeling of blessing, gift-giving, not imploring, like, may I be happy? No way. You know, so you can work with the tone of it. My friend Sylvia Borstein said it's like handing someone a birthday card and saying, may you have a happy birthday. May you have a great new year. May you be happy. May I be happy. Something like that. So you're walking along, resting your attention on the repetition of the phrases. Your mind goes way, 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 way off somewhere. You realize that. See if you can let go and begin again. Okay?